Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, we are live at the 2019 ARVO meeting in Vancouver, Canada. I'm joined here by two retina specialists. We're going to do a couple things. We're going to preview the May 2019 edition of Retinal Physician. These articles include a discussion of ergonomics for retina specialists, private equity, pros and cons, and loss to follow-up in patients receiving intravitreal injections. And we'll also talk a little bit about the highlights from the 2019 ARVO meeting in alphabetical order in this really, really fancy hotel room setup. I have Dr. Ajay Kurian from the University of Rochester to my right. Ajay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And first time on the program, Dr. Glenn Yu from Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at UC Davis in Davis, California. Glenn, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for letting me stay in your room, on your couch. So, guys, that was not a one-to-one financial trade, by the way. Starting with the retinal physician articles, and again, Glenn, it's your first time doing this with us, but for the listeners as well, our goal is not necessarily to summarize these articles. These articles are available online for free at retinalphysician.com, but more or less to quickly summarize it, and just go through kind of implications and some questions it brings up to foster some discussion. And if you want to read the articles and see what we're talking about, you can find them online. So the first one was about ergonomics for the retinal physician. It was fancy placement of the title of the publication within the title of the article that I them. Protect Your Musculoskeletal Health with These Tips for Daily Practice by Megan Nichols and Jeffrey Marks. And I'll just quickly summarize, you know, they just kind of looked at, discussed, obviously, musculoskeletal disease, or MSD, is something that unfortunately a lot of us are familiar. It's very common in ophthalmologists and retina specialists. We have our awkward postures. We have the stress of surgery where you're not necessarily readjusting while doing something or watching a fellow surgeon if you do have fellows. We're using a lot of forces on our hands at all times. I think we've all known retinal surgeons who need carpal tunnel surgery, for example. And we do really repetitive motions, whether that's injections or surgery or just indirect exams. It's not even that we're doing awkward postures. We're doing it in the same angles over and over and over again, which can lead to overdevelopment of some muscles, underdevelopment of others, and imbalances are bad if you talk to any physical therapist. So, Glenn, I'll start with you. You know, you obviously staff and teach fellows. What do you try to teach your trainees, your residents and fellows about ergonomics? What are kind of let's start with clinic, for example. What do you try to do for your setup to minimize kind of the ergonomic stress in your body?
Yeah, so for me, I always tell fellows that, you know, at the beginning, when you're first training, you don't really focus about posture. You're trying to accomplish the task, which is in the clinic, it's like doing the exam. But what you have to really focus on is to develop those techniques early, because you're going to be doing this for the next 20, 30 years. So you don't want to be doing, you know, you don't want to develop a bad posture from the beginning and then continue that throughout your life, because it's easy when you're young. But then when you're 50, 60 year old and still doing the same thing, you really don't want to be using the same bad postures. So in the clinic, I usually recommend that, especially when you're examining a patient in a chair, to make sure you raise the chair up. And then examine rather than bend down over them, especially if you're going to lean the patient back for indirect ophthalmoscopy. You know, always try to have it set up so that it's easy to adjust the height of the slit lamp when you're examining the patient. It's nice if you have a pedal that can electronically control the patient's chair height also, so that you don't have to, you know, bend down to the patient. And ultimately, I think for the clinic, it's also sometimes the design of the clinic rooms. A lot of the older clinics tend to be designed for the old days before the advent of EMR. So you constantly might be on a computer that's facing away from the patient. So you either have your back turned to the patient or you turn around to look at them and crank your neck. So as, you know, as people do renovations and upgrade their clinics, I think they really need to adjust or design it so that it actually improves the ergonomics of the physician.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point about the computers, that they didn't really, I mean, we're constantly swiveling back and forth sometimes with the way we're designed. And Ajay, I'll ask you your thoughts on the clinic too. One of the things you referenced, Glenn, is good habits, all right? So like, you're talking about developing good habits no matter what you do, not just to be good at your job. Ajay, I mean, I'll get your thoughts. And I think the other thing you kind of referenced was When do we start taking shortcuts? I notice myself is when we're fatigued or stressed. Mm-hmm. So if you're behind in clinic or you're tired, that's when I notice at the end of the day my back hurts more. Maybe because when you're trying to catch up, you're not being as diligent about mm-hmm. these things. And so maybe, again, things that aren't related to ergonomics, like making sure your schedule is not stacked a certain way, or mm-hmm. even just kind of hydrating or eating well during clinic. Things that we don't usually do,
yeah.
they actually may help your ergonomics later in the day.
Yeah, your color of your pee should not be brown.
The Glenn Yu rule. Ajay.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Glenn said. I think the key is to just be very mindful of it and try to make sure that, especially when you're watching trainees do their exam, if you see a bad posture or any sort of bad ergonomic
you slap habit. No, I'm just kidding. That's a joke.
That would not improve their ergonomics. But
no.
But just reminding
them. That'll be learner mistreatment. We wouldn't do that.
Correct. No. But just reminding them about their posture or the way that they're set up. I think the other really big point is in the operating room.
All right. Yeah, let's transition.
Especially when you have differences in sort of heights mm-hmm. or other things, it's very easy to just, when you switch, to just go into trying to jump into the surgery right away without actually adjusting everything. And so that's one of the things that I always try to make sure that everybody adjusts it so that they're comfortable before starting. And I think just keeping that extra attention, it only takes a few seconds to adjust things, but later on it could actually have an impact in the surgery if you're feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah, I remember a lesson I learned from general surgery, actually, when everybody's standing around the table, is that you actually always raise the chair, the patient bed to the shortest, tallest physician, because even if you're a short little attending, you can step on stools and you can still be standing, but you don't want a really tall person to be leaning over. Yeah. And they're very, very mindful because they're standing there for, you know, six, mm-hmm. 8 hours at a time doing surgery. Whereas for us, we often are, you know, we sometimes will have like tall attendings or short attendings who are like at the scope, and then you have a tall fellow that's crouched way over to try to adjust to that. So I think it's something that we should all think about. And, you know, especially for us with trainees, it's important to be mindful of everybody's posture going forward.
Well, I think that it's interesting because it doesn't directly impact our ability to do the surgery like pupillary diameter does, right?
Yeah.
So like when you're switching back and forth, so I feel like I've had to get better at this because I'm good at the original setup, but I'm the type of attending will switch back and forth multiple times during case. And then I'm really bad sometimes, especially in those busier days, about forgetting as we switch back and forth to get things adjusted mm-hmm. For myself. If I'm going from assistant chair back, and next thing I know, I'm crouching my neck, and then you don't realize that. With PD, especially if our PDs are really different, you can't do that. Yeah, so you're forced to adjust it each time.
Yeah.
But you can kind of cheat your way through the ergonomic part of it. But yeah, I mean, I think that the other thing that's really helpful for the OR that one of my mentors taught me was also even the patient positioning can be important. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if the patient's not far enough on the bed, you automatically are starting from a crouching position. If the patient's chin is tucked, you end up leaning more over the scope sometimes to do what you need to do. And, you know, again, knowing that your pedals are in a good spot for you. And the other thing is customization. Like you referenced different heights. I've staffed residence fellows from 5 feet to 6'8", right? So that's like what I can do math, 20 inches of difference, right? So like that, every single one of us is different in terms of like me, I like my vitrectomy pedals and my scope pedals like further away from myself because that way I like kind of stretch out and that's good for me. But if I switch with a fellow who's 5'1", and they can't reach the pedals, then that's not good because they have poor control and it's not good for them either. Because we always talk about tall people getting problems. And you're right, the tall people do get some problems. But I think the people on the other side of the spectrum can have problems mm-hmm. too. It's not usually in the back. It's usually in the legs and their calves mm-hmm. and their ankles.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other trick, I mean, I don't know, you guys do indirect laser in the OR. Okay. I felt like as a fellow, that was one of the hardest things on your body.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Especially if you have to laser like superiorly or anything that's awkward where you're kind of leaning over the patient.
Yeah.
Any tricks and tips for that, Ajay?
I think it's just
setting a fellow to do it.
I knew. See, I was waiting for you to say that, but now we have two Len Yu rules on zero. It's 2-0 already.
Bad example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
So. Well, actually, that's what was sort of done sometimes in fellowship is the fellow would do a lot of it and then switch. Yeah. But that may be bad. But.
Yeah, I think just making sure that you adjust the bed in the beginning. I usually try to tackle the most uncomfortable spot first so that I'm not doing it when I'm more tired and paying less attention to how I'm positioning myself and how the patient's positioning themselves, how the patient is already positioned. and then just trying to depress, I think that really helps so that you're not, so you can move the eye basically to where you need to have it for when you're doing the indirect laser, just doing that early. But yeah, it's definitely tough. There's certain times where you kind of have to cope with it because of the position of the general anesthesia, mm-hmm. and things like that. But that's why I tend to like to do those difficult areas first.
Yeah, some people are very creative. I know it's going to be a lot harder with, let's say, ROP, because you can't really position the baby that much. Actually, you can position the baby sometimes. But I've heard of people that are very creative for, like, indirect lasers. Like, they'll actually have a patient raise the bed all the way up to almost like head level, and then actually turn the head to the side, so you're almost like looking straight ahead to do the laser.
Nice on the back.
Yeah, and actually one of my colleagues used to tell me, even for indirect laser in the clinic, you would raise a chair so high and then actually sit on a chair, so that I've especially that. For a superior laser, you're just literally just firing upwards almost at the patient's eye, and he said that was very good on his back.
You know, the other trick I learned actually at a fellowship interview, which is, again, maybe common sense to some people, I mean, I'm a little bit on the taller side, is the wider you stand, the less stress you put on your back and the more you transfer to your hips. Now, it's not good to transfer all of that to your hips, but generally taller people tend to just crouch at the back, middle and lower back, and that's bad on your spine. Mm-hmm. But if you actually just put your feet a little exaggerated and make it more like a triangle shape, then when you turn and torque, you're not torquing your spine, you're turning at your hip joint. And so that actually is more adapted for that movement versus that repetitive torquing, especially usually because most of us stay on the right side of the patient. Like you said, some of our exam rooms aren't good about, you can't really walk around sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so we end up, especially if we're looking at a right eye temporally, you end up kind of torquing, twisting to the left to see it. Mm-hmm. So what about outside of work? Like, I mean, you guys, to be honest, do you guys believe things should be done outside of work to preserve your body? Like, what do you guys do anything special? Do you stretch? Do you yoga? Do you just think about doing yoga while eating a bag of Cheetos, like Ajay?
So I try to exercise as often as possible, which I think just helps overall. But I was actually introduced to yoga at the Vidbuckle Society for the first time, and I think it actually did help. And so I haven't actually incorporated, but I know other people who do swear by it. Dr. Sunir Garg is a really big proponent of it, and I think it could potentially help out with just making sure that you increase your longevity of being able to do things like operate and be able to position your body the way you need to.
What about you, Glenn?
I like low impact sports like swimming, where I think it's, compared to things like running, where it's actually could be pretty hard on your heels and your knees. Low impact sports, sometimes it helps to help regulate my breathing as well. So I think that's just general overall health. The other thing about ergonomics, besides just trying to strengthen your own core muscles, is like even just the way you set up your computer at home sometimes. I find that a lot of people, the actual optimal position for like a monitor, for example, is slightly below the eye level. So your palpebral fissures are a little smaller. You're looking downwards a little bit as opposed to cranking your neck back. Even like where you put your TV as opposed to hanging the TV very high up. And I think all those little things can all help to contribute to better ergonomics.
Yeah, the other thing that I didn't really think about until I got a really nice like pair of shoes for my birthday one year is footwear makes a big difference for me, at least. So like I'll go through pairs of shoes very quickly, and I don't even think it's about steps, because I'll check my phone and be depressed that I didn't actually walk that much as I thought I did. But it's something about the stress we put on our, at least for me, we put on our feet, the cushioning, all that. Generally, we operate without shoes, many of us, but in the clinic, especially because we're running around in rocking positions, if you have good footwear, that does take some stress off your legs.
I remember as a fellow, I actually walked so much that actually my shoe, like my entire heel fell off.
And like, oh, that's so funny.
I was like, it was such an old shoe, and all the techs were like laughing at me. They was like, well, Dr. Yu's running so much and ran so much, his shoe fell apart.
Oh my God. That happened to me. Do you remember? So when I was a resident during residence day, I walked up for my very first, one of the first year for my residence day presentation. And as I was walking up to the stage, the back of my shoe came off. And I just limped. No one really noticed. So I just kind of limped up there, did it, and limped back and just picked it up and ran away. But, well, anyway, so ergonomics, we spent a long time talking about. Let's talk about private equity. Now, obviously, all three of us are in academics. And so we, any of us are in a group that's either sold to private equity, considering, I mean, we're in a different scenario. But this article by Paul Wally and Michael Jacobson and David Eichbaum, which is the pro and con discussion of private equity for retina practices, was an interesting read. And I think this can be really, really confusing, right? So like they kind of define what the PE model is. They talk about how it's a little different than what happened in the 90s, and what was going on, because people have a lot of times compared it to what happened in the 90s in terms of the groups that were set up. They kind of list out why you would consider a private equity partnership and what sort of things you'd want to think about. And it's interesting because it has someone who did do this, someone who didn't do this. And I've always thought this was kind of what we needed. And actually, I would think the best would be someone who did do it, someone who didn't do it, a younger person who was in a group that sold, and then someone who's joining a group that has already been sold. Because I think those are all very different scenarios. What did you kind of take away as takeaways? And I said takeaway twice there, Badaji, but like, you know, you had to take away something, that given that's the third time I've said it in two sentences.
Well, I think the biggest thing is that it's a big issue right now in Retina. There's I forgot the exact number that they quoted.
And so here's my first question, and I interrupt. Do you think it's as big an issue as people think it is?
I'm trying to look for the number that was quoted in here for the number of groups that have already looked at private equity or sold to private equity. But it was actually surprisingly high from what I saw. But it's certainly something that people are talking a lot about. And so I think it is something that's on the minds of people in Retina, and especially for fellows who are coming out of fellowship, that I think is affecting the job market and the decisions for what job you're taking. And I think that part of it is that, as Dr. Eichenbaum pointed out, is that in some ways you are giving up some control, which is one of the very attractive things for having your own practice.
Yeah, I do feel like, especially for me, having chosen academics, I think one of the allure of going into private practice is being your own boss and having freedom. And I do think that it is it's tough, a decision. I mean, my takeaway from this article is that it varies from person to person. I don't think there's one right answer or wrong answer, and it varies from the specific scenario you're in. I think that it seems like a major con would be that you're losing a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. That you essentially can potentially, they have the decision to sell your practice again to someone else if it's not profitable to them, and you, because you're not the major share owner, you're shareholder, you're no longer making those decisions, and a lot about your own practice patterns and your clinical practice could change when someone else is in the control room. But at the same time, the pro is that, you know, there are a lot of external forces that are making it harder and harder to run, because you're running private practices, you're essentially running a business, and most of us are not MBAs. So the business is harder. So I think it the external forces are making it harder, and people don't know if they want to deal with that, to deal with the business side of it. So I think it's a good article.
You know, the last article was about loss to follow. This is a peer-reviewed article for patients with AMD and PDR by Anthony Obaid and Farina Ali from Wills. And we've actually talked about the actual journal articles before in the podcast, so we don't need to like break it down again. But essentially, they published these analyses looking at loss to follow-up, both for patients with AMD and PDR. And the big advantages of these studies is a large pool of patients and probably the best real-world kind of study looking at this. And they are kind of two separate issues we've talked about before in terms of the loss to follow-up. And I won't go into the details and the numbers, because we've talked about it before, and it's also available summarized really well here in a table in the article. Glenn, I mean, this is something that we've been discussed for about a year. I think this was first kind of released maybe around ASRS, maybe a little before ASRS last year. Year later, like, what implications has this made for your practice? Does this kind of reinforce what you kind of knew about these conditions? Does this change the way you interpret some clinical trial data? And maybe let's go condition by condition, because they're different. Let's start with PDR, right? So, mm-hmm. So what does this tell you about PDR? What does it reinforce or change for you in terms of how you treat patients with PDR?
I think the main issue, it's hard for me to say like how it changed anything, because I don't know if this information so much is something I can do anything about. I mean, certainly we know that there are major implications of having people lost to follow-up if they've only had one injection, let's say. And if you knew that your loss to follow-up rate was so high, you're probably more likely to do panretinal photocoagulation and PRP versus intravitreal injections for PDR. But, you know, the question, I think for me, the most striking thing is the high percentage, the fact that it's a quarter of people, like because I think we don't think about it because you don't see those people, so you're not reminded of the people that are lost to follow up. And so I think it's very eye-opening. And I also find that it's interesting that it's similar across different diseases. So it seems like it may be more impacted by things like demographics. And so I think it might help us guide us maybe thinking going forward, like if it's someone who, based on demographics, like older man who's or woman, but like essentially someone who's more likely to follow up, you're more likely to do something like intravitreal injections for PDR versus laser.
You talked about this before, but I mean, anything you want to add on top of Glenn said?
Yeah, I think Glenn had hit a lot of the high points, but I think the biggest issue is that this is certainly a real problem and can impact our outcomes. So we see all the time in our real world analyses of different conditions that the patients tend to do worse than the clinical trial data, and that they're getting less injections than the clinical trial data. But I think that in addition to those factors, I think one of the big factors is potentially this loss to follow-up or why they do worse, because they actually do usually wind up coming back into the system at a later point. And that's sort of when you really remember them, and it really hits home that importance of loss to follow-up, especially when they come in with a big submacular hemorrhage, if they have AMD, or if they weren't a peripheral diabetic retinopathy patient, then all of a sudden they're coming back in with NVG. That's when it really hits home that clinical point, the importance of loss to follow-up. I think that the surprising thing to me was that I actually expected the AMD patients to be better with the follow-up, because at least that's been my experience clinically compared to the diabetic patients, because of things like work and stuff like that to pull you away from being able to come to your visit in the diabetic population compared to the older population of AMD. But it seems like, at least in this study, that even the AMD population had a big loss to follow-up. And I think that there's certainly a little more dependency on another person for your ride and to your visit, and so maybe that's where that comes into play.
Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things I find that this is interesting, I went at Macula Society, I think Tom Chula gave a talk about real-world outcomes of patients with diabetic macular edema. And in most of the clinical trials, people gain on average about 2 lines, and in the real-world data, it's less than a line. And I think this really kind of points out one of the difficulties of interpreting clinical trials data, because most of those patients have really good follow-up, and that it's a very different population than what we experience in the real world. So I think that this could explain a large part of what's going on. It's not just under-treatment on the part of the physician, but follow-up or poor follow-up on the side of the patient.
Well, and patients outside of trial, even if they're following up, they have real life, yeah. Right? So, and your own clinic schedule may vary. You may be at ARVO in 4 weeks, and they come in 5 or 6 weeks. Maybe they can't come the 5th week because they have a wedding. And, right. You know, like, real-life stuff also changes your treatment patterns. And we don't know the impact of that. I mean, we just have to accept that things aren't going to be perfect in the real world. What do you guys – you know, the interesting thing I thought was also the cultural part of this, right? So one of the things they looked at was – African-American patients, PDR and AMD, higher loss to follow-up, even after adjusting for other factors. Asian patients, higher loss to follow-up for AMD. Now, this was only for AMD, not for PDR, but the percent of patients, I remember from the paper, who were Chinese or of Asian descent in the AMD group was much higher. So the numbers were higher for that group, and they had a higher loss to follow-up. I mean, cultural factors play a big role here, because I think even with patients who are of the same cultural background and speak the same language, it can be difficult sometimes to understand why they need repeated treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's even harder if you have either a cultural or language barrier that you're confronting. I mean, have you guys found that this is something – I mean, this seems like something that – and American Academy of Ophthalmology and other groups have done a great job putting together pamphlets and things like that you can give patients to kind of explain. But can we do things better maybe still as a profession to get across these differences?
So I think we're at least at my setting, I'm very lucky to have a pretty broad translational service, either through in-person or through telephone systems. And so I usually try to, at least in that initial conversation, have either a family member present or available on the phone to really go over the plan and what needs to be done and why it needs to be done, and try to reinforce to both the patient and somebody else there that this is going to be a long-term treatment. And afterwards, you know, a lot of times, just based on the level of communication, you could potentially keep not necessarily need the full translator there, or can rely on a family member. But I think for that initial visit, it's very helpful to have that translator there. And in addition to just explaining what's happening on that visit, explain what you're expecting to happen over the next year or two, that every time you see them, they're going to need an injection. This is a sort of a chronic disease that you're dealing with.
Yeah, beyond the language barrier, I do find that even just the cultural factor is important. So I'm Chinese and I speak Chinese, so I have Chinese patients that see me, and I don't think that there's a language barrier. But I actually get often very frustrated with Chinese patients because I think culturally they always like to come to the doctor and they would like to hear that everything's okay, mm-hmm. and they want to just go home. And the more you tell them you need to come back and get more injections, it feels like it's a negotiation with them sometimes, mm-hmm. at least with my population. Now, a lot of these studies were based on limited number of sites. Right. So it's hard to generalize because the population will be different. But at least, just even from the three different places, from where I've trained and also where I work now, I do find that certain cultures, like, people don't like coming to the doctor because they get the sense that they don't want to be sick. But you have to go to see the doctor to get treatment to be cured, but they almost don't. It's almost a little sense of denial, and I think that that's unique to certain cultures.
Interesting. Well, guys, just to wrap up, we're obviously at Argo. Vancouver's been very nice. The meeting has been going on. There's a couple big talks, and we'll get to those points. Ajay already called dibs on talking about Protocol V. We'll have a separate episode. Actually, it'll probably be up before this one, really going in-depth on Protocol V. Ajay, was that your biggest takeaway from the meeting?
Yeah, I think it was very exciting to see the results of that study come out. I think that, certainly had a long enrollment period. And it's an important question, I think, that the DRCR was able to answer. We see these patients all the time who have good vision with some macular edema. Questions: would they benefit from these treatments earlier? And we just didn't have that data in the clinical trials that are already done. The main take home points was that they didn't find a difference in the amount of loss of vision in the three treatment groups, which was observation, focal laser, or intravitreal aflibercept. But in both the observation and the laser arms, you had the option to treat if they essentially had an increase in fluid or worsening of vision. They were followed about every 4 months in those two arms. And so I think it definitely highlights the importance of fairly close follow-up for these patients, because we want to make sure that they don't develop severe edema that continues to go untreated for a long period of time. But if you are able to watch them closely, you could potentially have the same visual acuity outcomes over 2 years by just treating them when they need it.
What was your big takeaway, Glenn, from the meeting?
I think I had a couple. I think number one was the explosion of deep learning and machine learning and artificial intelligence. Exactly. At this ARVO compared to even just last year. When I remember a few years ago when we were talking about machine learning, there were just a few groups doing it. And then now what I find that's really interesting is that you see not just people from the regular places like a lot of the academic centers, but, places from other international sites. We had Google, Verily was there, Genentech had their own deep artificial intelligence division. Even the NEI had a group working on this. And I find that what's interesting about machine learning and deep learning is that, historically a lot of research is done using very fancy, expensive toys. Right, you've got your AO and your swept source OCT. So there are only a few places that can do these. Whereas I think machine learning, honestly, I'm not a computer science expert myself, but I feel like anyone who has a computer science background or have a high school student who can do this can download these open source algorithms and just be very good at computers and try to analyze the data. So I think it really leads to kind of like a democratization of research. And it really opens up the field. Some may argue that this also may attract a lot of not as high quality research or, more noise in the system. But I do think that a healthy competition is nice. So I think it's a good thing. It's very confusing now walking down those aisles, like how many people are working on deep learning and artificial intelligence. But I think that was really, really cool.
Well, Glenn Yu, Ajay Kurian, thanks again for doing this. Thanks for having me as your third roommate. And guys, again, if you want to read those articles, they'll be up on retinalphysician.com. And again, if you did not have a chance to go to the ARVO meeting, there will be plenty of coverage, I think, of the biggest trials, including Protocol V, as well as the deep learning algorithms. I mean, I think, again, I don't have enough of a computer science background to be sufficient, but someone much smarter and more talented than me will download that algorithm and change it into something great. So thank you, guys, and have a good one.
Thanks for having us, Jay.
Thank you.
And-
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 169 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Here's a huge update. You can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Click on the link in the episode description to be redirected to their website to claim your credits. On our website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Store or Android Store to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to the team at Retinal Physician for providing the articles, and to Dr. Glenn Yu and Dr. Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Vanacasa for the production of this episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the car.